Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Comedy Concepts with your host, Nancy Lombardo.
I like that little song. That song's by Tony Salvatore, by the way. You might know the guitarist. Very special guest today, one of my favorite performers in New York City as well as a writer, published several novels, six novellas, and hundreds of short stories and poems. He's law and review publications in Circus, the Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, Booksmith, Boston Herald, Ellery Queen. This list goes on and on. She's got so many awards to her writing, not only as a writer, a comedian, but also as a playwright. And her play, Strings, about string theory, was hailed by John Simon as the most absorbing play in New York today. How's that for credits? And it rhymes and it scans with Carol Bugay. Carol, are you there?
Hey, Nancy. How are you?
Good morning. I love your new book, Silent Screams. I could not put it down. I was like, what? Wait. I think I know what's going to happen. Wait, no, that's not it.
Oh, thank you so much.
It was very good. Now, you write Silent Screams under the name C.E. Lawrence.
Right. And that's because in thriller writing, there is a kind of a convention, which isn't held by everybody, but the idea being that the author could possibly be a man. So that's why the name, and also to rebrand the books, because like the mysteries and the Sherlock Holmes stories that I have and novels, they're all of a different genre. They're the mystery genre, which is not as dark as the thriller genre. It's a different demographic. It's a different type of a book. And so part of it was rebranding, and part of it was to maintain the idea for anyone who didn't actually know me that I could potentially be a man. The irony, of course, is that I chose my mother's maiden name. So actually, I am a Lawrence. I am a Lawrence on my mother's side. If my mother had kept her maiden name, my name would have been Lawrence. So...
Oh, okay. Well, I like it, C-E, but I also like that C-E can be an alliteration of some kind to C. Lawrence.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. You're the first one who's caught that. That is so good. I love that.
Well,
that's so good.
I like that you use that, and I like that. But this is your current novel, Silent Screams, and this
yes,
is published
that's
by...
Right. It's Kensington Press, and the sequel is coming out later this year. The sequel will be called Silent Victim. So the idea, I think at this point...
The same character then?
It'll be the same protagonist, the same detective, the same Bronx detective who is his sidekick, and then the criminal profiler will be the same guy too, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something to look forward to here. Now, let's start off for people who don't know about you. Let's start off with your background. You started in theater. Is that correct?
More or less, yeah. I mean, going way back to when I used to write sketches, well, as a comedy writer and comedian and multi-talented performer yourself, I'm sure you probably had the same similar thing in the childhood that I did, which is you probably wrote sketches for your family.
Did you write as a child, Carol? Did you write?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I used to write these what I thought were these these satirical sketches of my parents playing bridge, and of course and drinking, and I knew nothing about bridge or drinking, so I would have these bridge games where people were calling out 12 no Trump, and I'd make all my cousins and my sisters and everybody perform in them.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Oh, like 10.
10? Oh, that's great.
I mean, whenever there was a family holiday, you could count on some. I'm sure they were wretched. But my parents, bless their hearts, were a good audience. And I think.
Almost the name of a good book, Carol. Wretched Plays by Children. The Wretched Collection of Children's Plays.
Oh, that's so good. Maurice Sendak, where are you when we need you?
Wretched.
It'd be like children's cautionary. children's cautionary plays, only the plays, instead of being about children, would be by children.
By children, yes. Performed by adults.
Exactly.
I would pay to see that.
That's so good. Well, being a mother yourself, you probably have been, probably by now you've been to more performances than you would care to remember.
No, not really. My son has performed with me at the Mollapalooza festivals a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
Last year he just, so I have footage of him just growing, you know, 8 inches and whatever, but he said, I'll just announce you this year. So,
oh, really? Oh, so your son doesn't have the bug? He doesn't have the comedy bug?
I don't think he has the comedy bug, maybe the acting bug.
Uh-huh.
So you were writing before you were acting, and then you got in acting because I know you.
Well,
were
I was pretending. I was always pretending to be someone else. I mean, from the age of five, I think, at around four or five, I was Mighty Mouse for a couple of years, and then I was Davy Crockett, and... you know, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think it's all about...
Now, where did you have theater training or literary?
Well, more theater, I guess. My first... The weird thing is, you know, my acting teacher... This is so weird, but my acting teacher in when I was eight, you know, my parents shuffled us off to the college where my father taught because they had free classes and everything. So we had my sister and I were like, we were in modern dance, which we hated. We were in acting class, which we loved. And I had this wonderful acting teacher. Her name was Maggie Dillon. And later on, it turns out that her daughter, and she had this daughter who was quite a bit older than I was. Her daughter ended up, I still haven't met Denny since you know, I was a kid, but she was later on Saturday Night Live briefly, and now she lives up in Woodstock.
Wait a minute, are you talking about Denny Dillon?
Yeah.
The comedian.
Yes.
I know who she is. I know Denny Dillon.
Yes. Well,
in the 80s,
well,
she was big in the, well, I don't want to say it in a bad way, but she was big in the 80s.
Well, Denny was my acting teacher's daughter when I grew up in Ohio, and I still and I'm in Woodstock half the year, and of course everyone up there, you know, there's a group of people up there that's sort of a tight-knit, you know, artistic community, and they're always going, yeah, Denny, and I keep saying, wait a minute, and then I'd describe her and I'd say, does she come from Ohio? And he's, yeah, and I, her mother Maggie was my teacher.
That is that funny.
Isn't that so funny? Yeah. So yeah. So I had acting classes.
Oh, I know Denny Dillon.
I had acting classes from about the age of eight years old. But you know, because you were the first person I ever saw on stage doing improv. You and Tom Carosa, and it was such a magical memory for me because I had done improv as a kid. You know, and you know how the line between improv and writing—it's, you know how it is.
Yes.
It's so close, and most of us who are improvisers
different?
Are...
Different? Punctuation.
So most of us who are improvisers are really happy, you know, more happy writing than we are, you know, acting a lot. Well, I can't always speak for myself, but...
I like both. I mean, but yeah. I think I'm not... it's because I'm not as prolific with my punctuation because my mother wasn't from this country. And that, you know, they go, Nancy, that's quite the run-on sentence you have going there. So because of the punctuation, the writing, but I do like transposing it.
Yeah,
into,
Well, and also when you're writing plays or sketches, you don't really have to pay attention to the punctuation because the actors will do that for you, right?
Well, I think you bring up a very valid point, Carol, because in writing... Okay, you have to focus, you have to structure. In improvisation, there is no structure. Anything can happen and change in a second, which is very freeing, much like your writing. It's a back and forth, because in your writing, once you have it down, you are eight possibilities to the next thing that could happen.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. But I remember even when we were doing improv, I got very interested in structure. I mean, that was one of the things... I mean, I came to New York with the idea of doing theater for sure, but it was that I would have to say that what changed my life was that night that I saw you and Tom, and you remember Pete Spellis?
Pete Spellis, yeah.
Yep, I saw you and Tom and Pete and this short dark haired girl. Anyway, I saw you guys at First Amendment, and that
was
the night.
That was the first. Mara, I think her name was, or Laura, something.
Yeah, went at Theater 22, and I saw you guys on stage.
Well, that's
and
when
Bruce
Willis was with the group. Theater 22.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Bruce was. I remember I was doing lights when you guys were doing shows with Bruce, and And that was the night that I said, oh, my God, there's something other than acting that you can do that's way more, that looks way more fun. And
you
it was.
You don't memorize anything.
Well, and it, no, it's just so much more fitting.
You sing as well. I've heard you sing. I know you still improvise. And how do, now you've won so many awards. I can't even count them. It's like you've won the first prize winner of the Maxim. Playwriting competition, the Cronus.
Yeah,
Cavalier
that was for a little
prize,
comedy.
The Jerry Jazz Musician Short Fiction Award, the Gene Pava Memorial Fiction Award. Wow.
Well, it, you know, if you get, I mean, I guess I've been fairly lucky, but you know, there's a lot of awards out there I haven't won yet.
Okay.
No, there's a.
It's not just. I mean. Your book, Silent Screams. Oh, by the way, where can they get this? I do have a
oh, it's at all the. My website is celawrence.com, and
okay.
that has links to all the major bookstores. But
celawrence.com. There we go again, but with no periods.
Right, exactly. Just CE. Right, right. Yeah, you know, punctuation just gets in the way online, doesn't it? It's on. It's so my website has all the links, but you know, of course, I'm, and it's. It was at the. My publishers paid quite a lot of money to have it at the front of the store at Barnes and Noble the month that it came out, which was December. So if you walked into a Barnes and Noble, I think now it's been shelved on the. You know, in the thriller section, but it's certainly in all the big stores, and I would definitely support indie bookstores. You know, like any
a
other
lot
writer.
A lot of independent bookstores, but. Well, they should just go to celawrence.com would be the easiest way, unless you're at Barnes & Noble, and then I suggest you go up and strenuously and loudly ask, where is that book, Silent Screams, by C.E.
so
Lawrence,
good.
I heard so much about? And that's how you announce it in the store.
You're good, Nancy. You're really good. I feel like I should take a seminar from you on promotion. That is so. You are so good.
Well, that's the way I would, as I say, pimp my book if I had one out.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Do you have that book by Nancy Lombardo? I've heard so much about.
That's
but
excellent.
It was good. So this is interesting now because you've written so many books. This is your. Are all the novels mysteries?
There's two Sherlock Holmes mysteries, then there's an original series of three mysteries that take place in and around New York, and then this is my first thriller, so this is my seventh novel, but it's actually the first thriller, so it's all in the detective genre.
What were the other ones, were romance?
No, they were mysteries. They were straight. They were just straightforward detective mysteries. Again, two were Sherlock Holmes novels, and then two were just regular mysteries.
What were the name of those books?
So the Sherlock Holmes novel, which was my first published book, was The Star of India. And, you know, because of the Internet and everything, all these books are now available again, even though I guess my oldest one is about 10 years ago. The second one was The Haunting of Tor Abbey, which took place at an allegedly haunted monastery in England, and that was my Sherlock Holmes novel. And then there's a series, Who Killed Blanche DuBois, and then that became a series with Berkeley. I had three books, and where the detective was a 12-year-old girl, and actually the detective. Was a character I developed in an improv one night with Jeff Klinkenbeard.
What was the name of the detective?
Well, her name in my books is Meredith Lawrence, but it was actually Jeff who gave her her name. We were doing a show one night, and I started doing this really obnoxious little girl that I had never done before. I'm sure definitely one of my alter egos, really nerdy and smart, but, you know, she thinks she's smarter than she is, and she's kind of, and Jeff started playing her very lovable and patient grandfather, and you know how it happens in an improv, you just come up, and then Jeff started calling her Meredith, and I was like, okay, her name's Meredith, and then I guess when I went to write the books, I said, well, you know, let's see if we can have a child, you know, who's a precocious little genius, and she'll be the detective. So she became the detective in the
Interesting.
Series.
Interesting. I'm surprised Disney didn't jump all over that.
from your mouth to God's ear. They if only. You know, if Disney would jump all over me.
What was the name of the book? What was the name of the book again?
So it's Who Killed Blanche DuBois, and then that was followed by Who Killed Dorian Gray and Who Killed Mona Lisa.
Boy, yeah.
I just had
visions of you on a date through eHarmony. These are the books I've written. Yeah, I kill a lot of people in my books.
Not enough, apparently, though.
It's pretty funny.
It's great. Yeah. So how do you apply your comedy background to murder mysteries?
Well, I hope that one has, you know, if you've written in some of the plays I've written are comedies and all this kind of thing. And, you know, I always say once you're a comedy nerd, you're always a comedy nerd. I'm always watching stand-ups on television. And, you know, I just got excited about a couple of stand-ups that I saw on John Oliver's show.
Are you doing stand-up now?
No, you know, I've never done stand-up. Only brave people do stand-up. You do stand-up. You're brave. I remember I made a pact with Terry Summer and Ian Pryor years ago that we were all going to do stand-up by the end of the year, and by the end of the year, none of the three of us had done it.
Well, look at what you have done. I mean, you've branched out not only all these murder mysteries and your new book, Silent Screams, you've branched out, you've had musicals. So you've gone from murder to music.
Yeah, I do like writing. I do like writing musicals very, very much.
Now, are you a musician? I mean, that you.
I am. I was trained. My father was a pianist, and I was trained in classical piano. And then when I came to New York, I was classically trained as an opera singer. You know, for like 10 years, I took serious vocal training. But you know, that wasn't for me. I mean, that world was not for me. I mean, I didn't. You know, I studied really, really seriously, but it was not for me. I mean, I didn't want to become an opera singer.
Very interesting, because when you go to, I assume, what can only be mystery conventions.
Yeah.
You have, like, such an eclectic background in there. It's interesting that some mystery writers. Now, there's a whole group. There's actually, it's a name. I can't think of the name of the band, but I think Michael Musto is in it. Stephen King. Stephen King and somebody else I interviewed on one of my earlier shows.
They're in a band?
Yes, they have a band. And the name of it makes sense because it has to do with authors. I can't remember now. If my publicist, Gail Parento, is listening, and she can name
That's so excellent.
Band. And they're murder mysteries who have a band. Amy Tan?
Yeah, Amy Tan is in it? Wow.
Yes.
What does she play?
I don't know. I'll have to find that history.
That's so fun. Well, I've been playing classical music with a trio. Well, I'm involved in a classical trio, and then later today, actually, I'm singing with a medieval quartet. I shouldn't say medieval quartet. We're a quartet and we sing early music. So you know, I like doing that.
You know, of course, you just always inspire me. Just now, when you were saying that you're singing with what is it called?
The singing group. Well,
yeah.
we're a quartet. Actually, we don't really have a name. It's a good question. We should come up with a name.
What style of music did you say it was again?
Well, it's early music. We like to do, Thomas Wilkes. And Bird, William Bird, we like to do music basically from the medieval period to basically.
There was a book called Silent Scream.
Yeah.
By it all the time. By E. Lawrence, she wrote it. Yeah.
That's good. And we also do 20th century. Oh, we were doing the Randall Thompson Alleluia last week.
Where are you performing this? Say it again. So.
Well, we haven't. So far, we've only performed in my building. we've done my building's Christmas party a couple of years. And
writers too, or are they different jobs?
Well, one is Doug Nervick, who I think you might know from the improv world. He's he's our bass baritone, and my friend Tony Moore is an actor and a composer. And then Priscilla Holbrook, she's basically an actress singer. She's getting more into the singing things. So yeah, I guess we're all sort of a eclectic background.
Yeah, that is very eclectic. And tell me about your plays too.
Because
they've been at very, very prestigious theaters like the Players Club, Manhattan Punchline, Pulse Theater, Van Damme Street, Love Creek. Oh,
Playwrights Horizons, very good. And here. Wow.
Yeah. I guess the plays kind of span, they span a bit of I've written, you know, certainly some comedies, but I guess the play that got the most attention was a few years ago, I saw a special on television about physics, and it was on the Discovery Channel, and it was about string theory. And there was a story of these, it was the story of these three physicists who had come up with a new idea of the Big Bang and how to incorporate string theory, M theory, in the Big Bang.
I remember you telling me about this.
Yeah, and they were on their way to see this wonderful play by Michael Frayn called Copenhagen, which had played in London. Pardon?
Was this based on a true story?
Yes, exactly. My play Strings was based on a true story. So these three scientists and the beautiful part was they were at a string theory conference in outside of London, and they took a train into London to see Copenhagen, which was a play about physics. And on the train, they come up with a new idea for the Big Bang. And I thought it was such a beautiful story that I decided that a play had to be written about it. And I decided that even though I knew very little about physics, I was the person to write that play. So I studied physics for about a year and a half up in my cabin in Woodstock. I got out all the physics books I could find, and I actually made friends with two of the scientists, and I interviewed them, and then they advised me on the play, and then I wrote the play, and it caught the interest of Keir DeLay, who was in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes, he lives in Connecticut, I believe.
He does indeed, and with his lovely wife, Maya Dillon, who was our leading lady in the play. And so then Keir got interested, and my friend Marvin Kaye produced it, and then our third lead was Warren Kelly, who's a wonderful actor who works a lot, and then we cast Maya, and then we did it. It was done off-Broadway in New York.
Oh, that's such a great story, from murder to plays, to musicals, to you seem to keep so busy with this. And Silent Screams, again, just go to celawrence.com is a good way to pick this book up real quick. I couldn't put it down. I started to read it, and then I like the little isms you give people, you know, mannerisms and the cigar thing. Could you pick a passage? Would that be too much?
Oh, no, not at all. I'd be glad to.
Oh, I just would like the people listening to get a feel for it. This is really a good mystery. You got me. I didn't see it coming.
Thank you.
All right, anything you like.
So I thought I would read a passage. I don't have that many passages about people actually getting, mostly in this book, once people are dead, that's when, you know, the detectives turn up, and I don't show them being murdered.
Yeah.
But here's a passage where you see a girl right before she's about to get murdered.
Okay.
So I'll just read as she meets the killer, okay?
Okay.
Sophie wanted a cigarette. She knew she shouldn't smoke, but she desperately, dreadfully needed a cigarette. She sat at the desk in her dorm room trying to concentrate on the book in front of her. Film analysis by R. L. Rutsky and Jeffrey Geiger. And then she goes outside. Finally, she gave up. Moving quietly so as not to disturb her sleeping roommate, she grabbed her pack of Marlboro Lights, pulled on her boots and overcoat, and slipped out of the room. The fresh snow was silent and glistening in the street, soft and white and pristine, not yet sullied by the soot of engines and the pollution of the city. Sticking a cigarette in her mouth, she realized she'd forgotten her matches. She shivered, drew her coat tighter around her, and headed through the snow toward the deli on the corner of LaGuardia Place. The street was deserted, and the street lamps cast pools of light onto the softly falling snow. The flakes swirled and danced under the lights, caught up in the magic of the night. Sophie almost didn't see the man standing in the shadows of the NYU dormitory building. Seeing her, he took a step toward her. Need a light? His voice was soft, his face still half in shadow. Sure, thanks, she said. It was the last thing she ever said.
Also, a warning to quit smoking.
Yes, that's what it is. The whole book is a polemic on good health habits.
Good health habits, yeah. Yeah, that I don't want to give anything away. I forgot now that now I just remembered because I read the book a couple weeks ago. But I remembered the element that you have of the eyes always watching you kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's like those serial killers do. And of course, you know, I had to do a lot of research on serial killers in order to create.
Again, I'm thinking of sitting at dinner with you talking physics and killers.
Yeah, it's funny actually. And I wonder if people who do this for a living, whether they actually in fact do spend time sitting around talking about, you know, their work, or whether they just really want to get away from it. And
does it affect you doing all this research?
Pardon?
Does it affect you? Do you have bad dreams, or do you
No, no worse than usual. No, actually, last night I dreamed that my car was towed, which was one of the worst nightmares. You know,
I shouldn't have put you on such a tight deadline.
I know. I woke up going, "Wait, has my car been towed?" Oh no, it hasn't. So no, I haven't dreamed about being attacked by serial killers. But I also think that. Well, I don't know. I think if you do that kind of work during the day, that you probably get it out of your system, you know. Though I'm not dealing with real crimes. I'm only dealing with it in my imagination. I don't know what it would be like for people who are dealing with it in their, you know, in their profession. Although I have made friends with a couple of profilers. I took a course at John Jay College in criminal profiling, of basically criminal psychology. And my professor was wonderful, and Dr. Schlesinger, and he I know that he does that kind of work, and
what
I also
would,
made.
What would you say as a murder mystery writer, basically, or a mystery writer? What would you say from that profiling is the most interesting thing about it?
The most interesting thing about profiling.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like so many of the social sciences, it is definitely an art rather than a science. And
you think
I
intuition has a lot to do with it?
Yes, but I actually got the sense from being in class and from all of the reading that I've done and all of the shows that I've watched and all of the research that experience counts for a lot, a lot. In other words, you begin to see patterns. I think, you know, when I hear people talking about it, I think you begin to see patterns. You see beyond the obvious things that maybe an inexperienced profiler would snatch up and say, oh, that's a real clue there. That's a signature. And you see beyond that to perhaps what the real signature is. And I think the really interesting thing is that killers really have a very specific set of needs that are being addressed by not only by their killing, but by the method of their killing. And so I know it's become a very popular topic these days, profiling and signatures and all that kind of thing. But it really does, it absolutely does exist. And the very specific way in which murderers dispatch their victims, It has meaning, and you can often track their motive from the way that they kill. And it's amazing the kinds of things that you can tell about people, from
the way
that
they killed the person and the way.
Absolutely.
I noticed that in a lot of mystery movies, they would do something. They would go, look, the person brushed the victim's hair. And,
yep.
You know, so there would be certain things that would be, oh, that must tie back to the mother, brushing the
mother's
hair.
Yeah, oh, it always ties back to the mother.
I'm a mother. I get blamed for everything, no matter what I do. So it's fun. So now, are all your books Pinnacle Books from Kensington Publishing?
No, the Sherlock Holmes books are both St. Martin's Press, and the original series that the Who Killed series, Who Killed Master Bois series, those are Berkeley Prime Crime books.
Okay. So, wow. All right. You're under a lot of publishers there. How do you keep all that organized?
I let them worry about that. It's the kind of thing where, I'm sure you know this from the world of entertainment. It's so hit or miss in terms of what editor is looking at any given time, what publishing house has an opening, has a niche, whether or not your book that you've written fulfills a particular need of a particular publisher. You know, it could be that a year from now, you know, things will shift completely, and you know, St. Martin's might open or close a new division, and they might be looking. It just so happened that Kensington was looking for thrillers. They were opening a whole series, and so when my editor Michael got my book, she was, you know, it fit a need of hers.
Oh, okay. So you did the proposal, and then.
No, I had written the book completely.
Now, there's two, because I've talked to, interviewed a lot of writers on my show, and mm-hmm. some say, I say, what do you do to write a book? They go, well, I do an outline and a proposal. But
well,
you just write the book.
Well, now there's a big difference between nonfiction and fiction in that area. if you're a nonfiction writer, you can very, very often sell a book on a proposal and an outline, and maybe a sample chapter. With fiction, especially nowadays that publishing is shrinking and it's getting harder and harder for the so-called mid-list writers, which is just a euphemism for nobody knows who the heck you are.
Yeah.
You know, we like to call ourselves mid-list writers. So with the shrinking market and all, for a fiction writer, you know, even though I have a few books in print, you know, it's not like I'm a household name anywhere. So for us, To be able to sell a book on spec without having written it, it's very unusual.
Oh, okay. So that's the difference there. See, you learned something there. I found out the name of the band. It's
oh,
called
good.
The Rock Bottom Remainders. That's the band with Stephen King.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's wonderful. That reminds me. Actually, I've also been singing. My editor has a band, and I've been singing and playing the penny whistle and little background guitar. And my editor has a band, and they call themselves the Yonkers Stompers.
The Yonkers Stompers.
The Yonkers Stompers. Yeah, and they do kind of like Celtic. They do Celtic and old timey, you know, bluegrassy type music.
And you play with that too.
Pardon me?
And
yeah, I do vocals and a little penny whistle, you know, to the tin whistle, and some guitar, you know, just backup guitar. I'm not a great guitarist.
That's a great guitarist. But I do like, let's back to Silent Screams. I do like the little blurb you have there that you sent me, the press release.
Oh yeah, they. I think that Kensington wrote that probably.
Yes, I like a deranged killer's tweet.
Oh yes. Oh yes,
know,
yes, yes.
It's very nice. In the streets of New York City, the slasher chooses his victim.
Oh yes, they wrote that, and you know, this is the really weird thing. I actually had a job for a little while, not very long. I actually wrote book cover for Kensington some years back. Maybe I don't know five. 7 years ago,
okay.
I briefly had a job writing, and so there are people who do that. That's what they do, and they write cover copy. And I don't think I was that good at it, but the only one that I really was proud of, and I remember this one, was I had to write cover copy for a cookbook, and it was the Zen cookbook, and the phrase that I came up with was you know, for the title was when East meets Zest.
Oh,
and I was like, I was so proud of that.
I like that. I think I could do that.
You would be great at it because, you know, a little wit goes a long way in that field, I'll tell you.
I'm very good at catchphrases and branding.
Oh,
I think
you would be brilliant. Not that you need something else to add to all the things that you already do.
But I think that this episode is called Silent Screams, A Novel Idea.
Oh, I really loved that. I thought that was great. I saw that actually on the website. That was wonderful.
Well, that's the episode. If anyone is listening and wants to rehear this episode too, it's going to be archived probably in about 45 minutes, and that's what you're going to go. Silent Screams, A Novel Idea, and people can re-listen to this anytime they want to, and people come back to the show, or they're looking on the internet for, you know, books or mysteries and. They'll come to this page and they can re-listen. But it's so eclectic. The Silent Screams, too. That's another thing about your book. Yes, you weren't bloody. You were just scary.
No, I actually in the blood. Actually, the blood that's in there was at the assistant at the insistence of my editor. She's the one who said, you know, you really have to make the first killing more graphic, and you got to add some blood. And I was like, okay. And then as I worked on it, she encouraged me to be, you know, to be not only more graphic at places, but also to be more violent and have the killer escalate more quickly than he you know, had. Mm-hmm. So I have some, you know, dismemberment towards the end. And that was not in the original draft. But basically my attitude about editors is, you know, if they say jump, you just ask how high.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I just don't, I've never come across a situation where I felt the need to argue much.
Well, that's the difference between book writing and television writing,
uh-huh.
which and the two writers of Reno 911 said a funny thing about writing. They said that writing for television is
mm-hmm.
like having a beautiful new puppy and giving it to someone to give a haircut.
Oh my God, that's so interesting.
It's just like this isn't what I started out with.
That is so interesting, and these, and I love Reno 911, by the way. I just love that show.
Oh, they're
show.
Great writers. They're the ones also did the museum movies.
Yeah. Oh, did they write the
yes.
Night in the Museums?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So they the names don't come back to me at that. It seems like a lot of people that you would meet in real life. Like, for instance, I have a friend would make a great character in any of your books, a comedian, Michelle Ballin.
Uh-huh.
Michelle has got this great gravelly New York voice, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So when you meet people, like, oh, by the way, I want to plug Michelle Ballin, and she's performing with Marion Grodin a Thursday, the 11th, 8 p.m. at Gotham Comedy Club, 208 West 23rd Street, 8 p.m. Go see
oh, great.
Michelle Ballin at Gotham. She's great.
Great, thank you.
So, but her voice is like that, and she's very
yeah.
funny, but she's got a very character esque quality to her. Do you ever, you live in New York City, do you like, are any of the people in this book like neighborhood people?
Well, they're not at all, because I generally speaking, I don't like to put real people that I know in books. I tried that once, and it was so funny. I actually put a guy, I was doing an industrial out in Arizona, and we were there for a week. I was with do you know Andy, oh, what's his last name? He's out in California now.
Shear.
Kind of a, what?
Shear?
No. I'm blanking on his. No, he's a performer. He's a redheaded guy, sort of medium height. Yeah. I'm blanking on. Oh, I can't remember his name. That's terrible. Anyway, well, he was out there. And I met this amazing man. He was a full-blooded Cherokee, and his name was Tujo. And he was one of our guides, and he was this just physically and in every other way just an extraordinary person. He was, you know, about 6'7", you know, weighed I don't even know how much, and he told me that he had actually lost like 50 pounds. And he had long, straight black hair down to his waist. I mean, he was an amazing guy. And so I thought, what the heck, he's so interesting, I'll put him in a book. Well, it's the one and only time that a critic has actually singled out a character as being not very believable. I mean, not that I haven't had bad reviews, but just that's the only time that a critic actually said, you know, I'm not so sure about that character, not really very good, you know, and I was like, oh, God, you know.
Well,
and,
there'll have to be a murder mystery that kills critics.
Oh, God, I bet there have been.
Oh, there was a movie, Who's Killing the Great Chefs of Europe or something like that, or Who's Killing
But my caveat is about the you may have noticed that there was a character in Silent Screams by the name of Eddie Pepitone.
Yes, and I was going, wait a minute.
Yeah, so he was named after, you know, my beloved friend Eddie Pepitone.
I love Eddie Pepitone.
Yeah, everyone loves Eddie, but he's a great guy.
He got on Last Comic Standing.
I know, I saw him on that. I was rooting for him. I TiVo'd every episode because I wanted to see Eddie.
Well, Michelle Ballin was on Last Comic Standing.
Was
too.
She on that? Oh,
yes, she was one of the last women Comic Standing.
Oh, and I probably shouldn't say this, but she was better than the one who won.
You can say that. Michelle's not going to mind.
Yeah, I really I remember her now, and I did not approve of the winner. And not just because Eddie didn't win. I thought there was a half a dozen people who were way better than the woman who won. So that
Oh, yes. Jane Condon, a comedian, she has a great story. I mean, she slept in her car to stand in line. To the,
oh, my story. God, really?
But she made it up to the first round. So
oh.
She passed there, but I was there. I thought it was hilarious. I wasn't going to stand in line. But, you know. Some people get auditions for that because that's coming up soon. And that they got auditions for it. And other people, you know, 200 people in line, I just think that's kind of a...
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. Like, just send an email, for God's sake. You know what I mean? I mean, this whole idea of waiting in line, it's punishing the people who would like to perform
for the sake of
publicity.
Well, it's scary because it's the desperation. Whereas Jane is a very good comic, so I'm not saying she's desperate, but it was something that she felt she had to do. And she did it. And she got in, and she auditioned, and she slept in her car, and she, you know... But and she got in, and she did make it up, and she's a very good comic. But
How did she feel? Did it have any impact on her career, did she think?
You know, I have asked a lot of people. You know, Bob Greenberg. I asked him, too, because he was...
Oh, sure.
What's that one they had? Something You Can Entertain, or Bob Greenberg. I have to look it up. But he was on something, America Performs, and he did Ralph Cramden.
Oh, yeah, I know Bob.
Yeah, Bob Greenberg, okay.
Sure.
And I said, did it change your life? And he goes, not really. So I don't know. Now, Michelle Ballin, I would say she goes that it did in a certain degree, or anybody who got on it, it did change it a little bit because it's a great credit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I thought Michelle's was more universal humor. Now, I don't know if it had anything to do with ageism or what, how they win this. Who did it? Who won that year? I don't remember who won.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I haven't asked Eddie whether or not it helped his career, but he was, you know, in the semifinals and, you know, got all the way as far as the semifinals. So my character of Eddie Pepitone is not Eddie himself, but it's inspired by a character that he, you know, that he played.
Now, do you have to get a release when you use a real person's name?
You know what I did with Eddie was I just called him up in California. When the book was going into final draft, I called him up and I said, look, Eddie, tell me something. Will this upset you if I put your name? And it's not you, but I just love I loved the character on it, and it was very much like a character that Eddie would have played, you know, doing an improv or doing you know, we did like this old-fashioned radio thing once with Russ Mason, and Eddie played this character that just reminded me of this guy. And so Eddie said he thought it would be fun.
Oh.
And then I found out that Chris Gravenstein has used, like, Tom Carosa and stuff in his books.
Oh, did he use Tom Carosa? He did.
When I was at Tom's bowling party.
Oh, yeah. Tom said he got a copy of the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we missed you. So I saw Chris, and I hadn't seen him for years, and he's, of course, very successful. And
unbelievable, isn't it? I told him, I said, I stopped buying the books at 2. I'll tell you why. I said, Chris, you're turning them faster than I'm making money. So.
Oh, bless his heart. Well, I'm very impressed. He won an Agatha, which is a very, very big deal.
And
you
know, he's gone from advertising to that. Yeah, I've asked him to be on the show, too. He's like, I think he's shy.
Oh, that's crazy. Chris, but he's a comedy guy. What's his problem?
I don't know. It's just people, you know. It's just, I think he would be on it. He's just shy about it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know. But this is a really good book. I would say, you know, what I like about this book, I definitely would pick this up for a trip. Because you can't put it down, you know.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
So I think if you're at an airport and you see it up on the shelves,
I would get
this book as an airport read. It's a very good read.
Oh, good. Well,
you'll be focusing on the bad flying. You'll be focusing on the book.
Yeah, right.
Is that a bump? Oh, wait a minute. It was the book.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, it's definitely the kind of book that you could certainly find in an airport. And I
like this one line in here just because it was such a nice visual.
Mm-hmm.
Which I will read. He goes, he especially liked walking from the bright sunlight of a Sunday morning into the tall, vaulted interior of the church. He loved the cool stillness of the stone columns. I like that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And of course, that is from the killer's point of view.
That's interesting because it is a killer. But also, it's also like a dreamlike state.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I think now that you're mentioning it, I think maybe a lot of the I have those very brief chapters from the killer's point of view, and I think that that was what I was going for without really putting it quite in those words. But I think that you've hit on something, you know, that this kind of a almost that he's in a fugue state, you know, when he kills. And I don't really know what kind of state serial killers are in. I know sometimes some killers
are obviously I don't think they're in a reality state because, I mean, or a moral state.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they're on a third level. But it's interesting. I just felt that, you know, it was like that stimulation, that mental stimulation that he got from walking in there.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, anyone
who light to dark is kind of interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh,
so,
good. Yeah.
You know, that
yeah. You have another career awaiting you as a literary critic. I think you've caught. I think you've caught on to and again, you know, without really thinking about it, I think you've caught on to a motif there of the notion of, you know, walking from the light into the dark. I mean, I think that's really good reading on your part.
Oh yeah, and it's just, you know, the coldness of the stone. But I like that sentence. When I saw that, I was like, oh, let me mark this here.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, it's funny. I that's one of the things that matters to me a lot when I'm writing. I work harder. Well, plot. Everyone works plot. You sweat blood on when you're trying to put a plot together. But apart from plot, I think I work the hardest on description and, you know, trying to put together sentences that I find attractive and that I find, you know, and looking for just the right metaphor and just the right moment. And I really appreciate reading other writers who do that. And my favorite writers, I don't care whether they're, you know, what genre they're writing in, but I really like a good style. And if someone is a good stylist, you know, that matters a lot to me. And I don't think it matters to every crime writer, but it matters a lot to me.
Oh, well, while we've been talking on the air, I just got an email that the show has been, probably due to you, added as a favorite. to somebody's other radio show. So congratulations on that. Well, I don't want to keep you. I don't want you to have any more nightmares. Let's talk about this book. It's Silent Screams. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. It's by C.E. Lawrence, Carol Bugay. C.E. Lawrence, Silent Screams. You can also get it at C.E. no periods, Lawrence.com. Get this book. It's fun. You won't put it down. You know, I kept going back to it. I love the characters in it. I love that you scared me.
Oh, good. It did scare you then?
Oh, yes. I just keep thinking somebody's watching me at all times when I'm out in the country now. Then I'm thinking I'm safe. I'm not in college.
So, oh, right.
You didn't kill any old women, so. Nobody in ARP gets killed in this book. No members of ARP were harmed in the making of this book.
Oh, come on. You're not old.
No, I'm not.
Great, Carol.
This is great and reminiscing with you. And please come on the show again when the next sequel comes out, which is due out in...
It's due out later this year, and we don't have a pub date, which is not unusual. It's not necessarily, you know, we had a pub date originally, which then was postponed for the first book. So I would be hesitant to, you know,
well,
say
okay.
when.
To read this book first if they want to read the second.
Well, they can, but we also have very cleverly crafted the second one so that if anyone does start with the second book,
it's okay.
They will. We don't have any spoilers about what happens or who the killer is in the first book. So that will allow people, if they should happen to stumble on the second book, they can go back and read the first one.
Well,
and again, that's something that you know, that I wasn't that hip to, and so my editor kind of stepped in and said, you know, you really, you know, in the second one, you absolutely cannot give away what happens in the first one. So that's, again, something that I think anyone who's...
For.
Yeah, and there's plans for the series to continue. I mean, if all goes well, you know...
A pinnacle book from Kensington Publishing, and that's in Barnes & Noble now, or you can go to celawrence.com and get it right away. And
yeah, we have links to Amazon.
Look up all of Carol's books, or C.E. Lawrence, or who's your other name?
Yeah, those are the only two.
Oh, Carol, okay, C.E. Lawrence. I like C. Lawrence,
yeah.
Or Carol Bugay, but these are good. It's you won't put it down, and I think I have a review of it on Amazon. No, I have a review somewhere of your book. I think I did. Didn't I? Yeah, I have to check it out again, maybe on my blog. But it's a very good book,
and pick it up and read it. And Carol Bugay has been my special guest with all of her various bands that she's performing in.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy.
And it's been great having you on. Don't forget, Michelle Ballin will be performing the 11th February at Gotham Comedy Club, 8 p.m. with Marion Groden. Go check her out because I love Michelle. And Carol, good luck with these books and keep writing.
Thank you so much.
Disney, if you're listening, she's got a girl detective. Come on, Disney, hop on.
Thank you, Nancy. It was a pleasure talking with you.
All right, Carol. Thank you.
Take care.
Blog Talk Radio, Comedy Concepts Blog Talk Radio. This Thursday, my special guest will be award-winning, record-breaking author, comedian, Fran Capo. Stay tuned. Big kiss.